No, I chose some title like this: nanoscale charge spin orbital correlations in complex materials. And here the idea is something like this: some kind of nanoscale clusters with correlated charge spin orbital degrees of freedom acts like a composite degrees of freedom in some of the complex materials. That's something I like to discuss. And there are a few recent examples, some CMR magnetite case. For example, at very high temperature, above Curie temperature, there is nanoscale charge orbital correlations. And this plays a very important role for transport properties in the CMR systems. And another example is like this. Again, in CMR magnetite, there is something called the magnetic nanopolar regions. In ferroelectric relaxer field, this term, nanopolar region, NPR, is a well-established concept. And in this CMR magnetite case, we see magnetic version of that. Okay, a very small nanoscale magnetic nanoscale regions with magnetic moment that appears in very defined temperature window. And that's the second topic. And third one is something I call octamers in spinel compound. So spinel is coming in. Copper iridium sulfide. And another one is this hexamers in another spinel compound. So my original plan was I discussed these two topics today. And if anybody is interested about these other topics in CMR magnetites, then I can discuss this in the next informal talks. As far as I can tell, this pretty much covers kind of recent development in CMR magnetite. And probably even this topic can be kind of a 1 hour talk. So I'm not sure if I can cover them all, but at least that was my plan. Okay, so again, today I will discuss this hexamers and octamers in spinel compounds. So I'll discuss these two compounds, zinc chromium oxide spinel and copper iridium sulfide spinel. My talk is based on these two Nature papers. So let me start from this structure. So spinel compound, chemical formula is like AB2, oxygen 4 or sulfur 4. And very often, the only magnetically and electronically active ion is B ion. A ion or oxygen is magnetically or electronically pretty much inactive, so that B lattice is the one we're going to consider most. And here we see B ion lattice of spinel structure. So the basic unit is this tetrahedron, so 1, 2, 3, 4, B ions, and they form this tetrahedron. And these tetrahedra, they share corners, so that B ion lattice of spinel structure is three-dimensional corner-shared tetrahedral network. It's very complicated. And unit cell is shown like this. This is a cubic unit cell for spinel compound. This structure can be viewed along 111 direction. So this is the origin, and this is the 111 direction. And along this 111 direction, this structure has two types of layer stacking. So this direction view is actually the same with that direction view. That's a 111 direction. And you can kind of see, you see this triangle here. So triangular layer is here. Triangular layer or hexagonal layer is there. And then the next layer is a Kagome layer. And Kagome layer you can see kind of here. So they stack along 111 direction. I know it's not so obvious, but the stacking looks like this. So here, maybe less obvious. But here what we see is that three kegomer layers and then two hexagonal layers along 111 direction. Okay, so for example, we see, maybe start from here. Here you see large triangle, and they form hexagonal layer. And then next layer is like this. Next layer is a kegomer layer having this David star as basic unit. So they stack like this, hexagonal layer and then kegomer layer, and they alternate along 111 direction. Now, this view has been popular for the field of geometry frustration. And let me briefly tell you about the history of spinners. So history of spinners. So there is a long history behind the spinner compounds. This magnetite, about 2 millenniums ago, starting from this Greece. And here what we see is magnetite crystal, natural crystal, mineral crystal. And the shape is more or less octahedral shape. And this triangular facet reflects this triangular shape in the 111 plane. Okay. And the name of this spinner is actually the name for this compound, this mineral, magnesium aluminate. And the structure, rather complicated structure, was first figured out by Bragg in 1915. And this Volvic transition in this magnetite, iron oxide. Probably many of you are aware of this 1941 paper, this theoretical paper. But this transition was experimentally found 29 by this gentleman. And this spinner compound is technologically also a very important compound. For example, radio frequency antennas. And first oxide superconductor, lithium titanate, forms in the spinner structure. And also first oxide heavy fermion compound, lithium vanadate, also formed in the same structure. Okay, so this is the same person, same David Johnston. And this is a very young David Johnston, and that is not so young David. And more recently, in the physics community, this compound has been popular for this study of geometric frustration issue. Three-dimensional version of that. Now, throughout this long history, somehow this very interesting geometrical aspect has never been realized. And that's found only very, very recently. That interesting geometry is something like this. So if I go back to this structure, so the spinner compound structure, B lattice, it looks rather complicated, but this entire B ion lattice can be decomposed into this hexagon. So here we see one hexagon here, but by stacking hexagons with four different orientation, we can tile the entire B ion lattice. It's very interesting geometrical aspect. The tiling can be done like this. So again, this is a three-dimensional tetrahedral network can be completely tiled by four types of hexagons. So one hexagon, another one here, another one there, another one there. So just four different orientations, we can tile the entire B ion lattice. If you look at this along 111 direction, then the tiling looks like this. Again, four types of hexagons, and we can pile completely without leaving any orphan sites. Yes.
The red hexagons are the ones that are the center of the Kagome things, right?
Well, I chose one direction. So this case, let's say 111 direction.
All of them are center of some.
Yeah, some direction, right? In other words, this is the 111 direction, 111 plane.
You can also
on this 111 plane, we have this hexagon. But if you go like 1 by 1, 1, one of these other will be centered. So on and so forth. Okay.
You can tell a two-dimensional Kagome like this is hexagon.
Sure.
Also, right? And this would be just
three-dimensional version of that.
It would be right, exact three-dimensional analog of that, correct?
Three-dimensional analog of that. You can say so. Yes.
Are the four series of hexagons equivalent or non-equivalent?
Say again, I'm sorry.
Are they equivalent or non-equivalent?
They are all equivalent. Yeah. Crystallographically, they are only...
You could make a cut in another direction and see the green in place of the red. So
that's correct. You can move around. In other words, choosing one kind of a decomposition like this is kind of a spontaneous symmetry breaking type. Okay. Now, as you can see here, they are decoupled. These hexagons are decoupled. They don't share anything. So for example, like this hexagon and that hexagon, they don't share anything, but they are kind of coupled through this tetrahedron. Okay, that tetrahedron, these hexagons are coupled through that tetrahedron, but they are decoupled. There is no corner sharing or edge sharing, anything like that. Yes.
So we can also say, right, that we have four Kagome lattices,
yeah,
which are not overlapping, and form together this three-dimensional structure. And in each tetrahedron, each corner participates in one separate Kagome plane, right?
Well, but the structure is not just the Kagome. It is Kagome and hexagon, Kagome
and
hexagon.
If you do it on parallel planes. But my understanding is that you can make four properly oriented deep Kagome planes and just bring them together and you will get spinel. On the billet of the spinel.
Maybe. In other words, I mean, if you look at just one direction, you have to have a hexagon.
Of course, yeah.
You have to have a hexagon. And then the question is, by cutting different, let's say, four different orientations, whether we can also decompose into Kagome, intersecting Kagome layers.
No,
that I'm
some,
not
sure. I think
sure.
It's the case that you can have this. The funny thing is you can have this
four different orientations.
You just bring them together and don't overlap them.
Don't overlap them, then it works. Okay, maybe. Okay, maybe.
Can you put back the
which one? This one.
Yeah.
This one. Okay.
I want to make sure I understand. So the brown hexagons are say in one plane, and then the blue ones are perpendicular to it. I mean.
No, it's not perpendicular. It's some strange angle they come in. About something like 127 degrees.
So we have to think of different planes.
Yeah.
Different planes. That's correct. Different planes
which
intersect. Okay, so let me show you this this millimeter size crystal, right? So we have this triangle here, that triangle, and the other one and fourth one behind, right? So some of this direction, let's say if this guy is parallel to that face, then the next one is parallel to that phase, so on and so forth. And then there are four different orientations. That's the idea.
But sorry, I'm confused about what
I'm confused about that too. So I'm not sure if that can be done. But this can be done. That is my point.
I have a question for one member of the audience.
Okay.
The Kagome cannot really be paid.
No, that's right. Yeah, we just talked about it. That's right. Okay.
Yeah.
So his red lattice is not Kagome.
Exactly.
But no, it's not.
But you can actually take four Kagome, and I think you can, if you take four real Kagome, you can make a spinel out of them.
Okay, perfect.
Okay, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
Okay.
I mean, the structure is so complicated so that clearly we cannot figure that out here. Okay. So, tiling. You know, that kind of tiling is possible. And another kind of tiling we found, that is having this kind of motif, instead of hexagon, and having two more two more like this. So this hexagon plus one, another one there. So eight B ions form this object. I call this octamer, eight sides. So hexagon plus two more. Again, the entire B ion lattice can be decomposed into this object. You can do complete tiling, which seems impossible, but somehow this very interesting and manifold topology of spinel structure allows this kind of decomposition. Once we do that, these octamers look like this. So again, the B ion lattice, let's say one octamer here, next octamer there, and the next octamer there, so on and so forth. We can cover the entire structure with this object without leaving any orphan site.
So now you choose only two types of hexagon. You still have the four types?
Okay, very good. Okay, very good question. So in fact, of course, we can have four different orientations, but even with two, we can cover them all. We can cover them all. It doesn't have to be this and that. It can be third one or fourth one, but just choosing two, we can still cover them all. Okay?
But that breaks the symmetry of.
That does break the symmetry, obviously. So that's again kind of a symmetry breaking type. And in fact, that happens in one of the systems I discussed, and that shows up as domain structure. Okay, so again, this kind of tiling is possible. And we just simply couldn't figure out, we experimentally couldn't figure out whether we can do anything more than this. Octamer, and then there may be even bigger object, and we can still do tiling. Again, I really wish some of you guys or some so-called graph theorists can do good artist to draw this. Okay, and this octamer decomposition, looking at along 111 direction, they look like this. So one type here, and then another type there, so on and so forth. Just this different thing, different this color tone is just the different layers. So this is the same layer, same 111 layer, and the next 111 layer, so on and so forth. So that there are only two kinds here, two different orientations, not four. Okay? So this is very interesting geometry. Here again, I emphasize, they don't share anything. They're decoupled. They're connected through tetrahedron. So this very interesting geometry influence physics a lot. Okay, so that will be the main topic. Let me just overview what I have discussed. So B lattice of spinel structure is in fact identical with B lattice of this so-called pyrochlore compound, 227 pyrochlore compound. And this spinel and pyrochlore compounds, it's extremely rich phase. There are many compounds forming in this structure. And in fact, if I combine these two together, then probably the system is as rich or even richer than perovskite. The structure can be viewed as this three-dimensional network of tetrahedra, or 111 direction, we can do this kind of stacking, Kagome layer and hexagonal layer, or we can do also this kind of tiling. I remind you, they are decoupled. No sharing. So for the rest of this talk, I discussed that these two compounds, so zinc, chromium oxide, insulating system. This is anti-ferromagnetic. Of course, zinc is non-magnetic. Chromium is magnetic. It has spin 3/2. It's anti-ferromagnetic, and anti-ferromagnetic coupling in this scale is huge, order of 400 Kelvin. There's very strong anti-ferromagnetic coupling. However, long-range order transition temperature is only 12 Kelvin, and this big difference is due to geometrical frustration. Okay, and that compound, copper iridium sulfide, copper is 1+ here. 1+ copper is non-magnetic, Iridium is this mixed valent state, 3.5 plus, and this system undergoes metal insulator transition at about 220 Kelvin. And iridium 3 plus is non-magnetic, it's a low spin state. Excuse me. Iridium 4 plus is spin 1/2, again, low spin state, it's B5 and then B6 here.
Is it copper 1 plus?
I don't know.
How do you know?
Experimentally, it is 1 plus, kind of X-ray absorption type experiment shows copper is 1 plus. And somehow, not just this compound, there are many copper something sulfide spinel compounds. There, somehow, copper is always 1 plus. Okay, well, I'll just show you one crystal of this spinel. Again, this triangular facet reflects the fundamental atomic scale triangles in the structure. So I'll start from this copper iridium sulfide compound. So this compound undergoes matter insulator transition at around 230 Kelvin. In metallic state, it's more or less Pauli paramagnetic. And in insulating state, it's a diamagnetic. So there is no spin, diamagnetic. Metal insulator transition, the insulating state is non-magnetic. There are no localized spins. And at this temperature, there is a huge structure distortion. So above the transition temperature, the system is cubic. And here what we see is X-ray peak position, X-ray peak position. And these two peak positions go up, that one goes down. Basically what this means is A and B, latest constant, A and B contracts. Going up here means contracts. And going down here means expands. So C expands and A and B contracts. And that difference is about 3%. There's a huge structure distortion. This 3% is huge. The structure is triclinic, but the primary distortion is a tetragonal type. In any case, there is kind of another transition at lower temperature. First, I'll discuss about that transition.
So this is higher symmetry at low temperature.
Good point. I'll come back to that issue. Okay, so the synchrotron X-ray data looks like this. One of the peaks, so one peak, cubic peak, suddenly splits like that. In fact, the structure is a triclinic. And amazingly, at low temperature, somehow the structure becomes more symmetric than high temperature. That's strange. And this transition, this 230 Kelvin transition, not just the structure latest constant change. In addition to that, all kinds of superlattice peak do appear. Superlattice peak like this, like that appear. This is an electron diffraction pattern. Now, basically with the refinement for this insulating phase, by combining electron diffraction data, synchrotron X-ray data, as well as neutron scattering data, we combined all these techniques because the structure is so complicated, so that we have to combine all those different diffraction data. So for example, like electron diffraction and synchrotron data, we have seen something like this, and this is all neutron scattering data. So by combining all these different experimental techniques, and the result of confinement is, in fact, the one we saw. Okay, so this is what we found. So basically, what happens is at high temperatures, poly paramagnetic metallic state, but in the insulating state, there is charge ordering between iridium 3 plus and then iridium 4 plus. There is charge ordering. And the charge ordering basically, through the charge ordering, this kind of iridium 4 plus octamers and iridium 3 plus octamers, they split like this. And the way they stack in three-dimensional lattice is something like this. Okay. So this is the iridium. The red one is supposedly iridium 3 plus. And blue one is supposedly iridium 4 plus. And iridium 3 plus is non-magnetic. But iridium 4 plus is supposedly spin 1/2 for each lattice point. But somehow the system becomes non-magnetic and it becomes diamagnetic in the insulating state. Yeah?
Isn't it that if you take just one blue ring, for instance, it looks like there are two or even three crystallographically inequivalent positions within this ring now?
You mean this one?
Yeah.
Here?
Yeah, but they have different bonding. Like this guy has...
You mean this one and that one?
Yeah, what that means is if you take this guy, he has bonds with two, three isovalent ions, and this other one has only two. So they must be crystallographically inequivalent, even remotely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for this one, and then, of course, that one is different, right? Because there is this one, and in that case, there is a red one comes in nearby. Yes. Yeah. They that is true. Yeah. Through this kind of decomposition, more than one lattice point shows up. In fact, that's why superlattice peaks show up. So that is consistent with the appearance of superlattice peaks. Anyway, this is supposedly spin 1/2 for our object, but overall the system becomes non-magnetic. So that what happens is spin dimerization occurs within iridium 4 plus octamers. So for example, these two spins dimerize, and those two spins dimerize, and these two spins dimerize, and those two spins dimerize. So that even iridium 4 plus octamers becomes non-magnetic. So that the entire system becomes non-magnetic in the insulating state.
So this means dimerize means that they become like anti-ferromagnetic, or?
Really, spin dimerize, so spin zero object.
Yeah, but I mean, say if you do their real spin zero object, or they just two opposite spins.
No, it's the real spin zero state. Real spin dimer. It's not just the anti-ferromagnetic state. Real spin dimer. So it becomes non-magnetic state. Okay, and the way spin dimerization occurs is what we discussed here. But if I go there, this and that, they are more or less in this direction, like one bar zero direction, and that direction is something like 1-1-0 direction, and this all goes to the same direction, and also that also goes all same direction. So it's either 1-1 or 1-1 bar. So this dimerization induces a huge structure distortion, lattice contraction in A and B lattice constant, but C expands. Is it clear? So this and also that is more or less in the AB plane, so that when spin dimerization occurs, lattice contraction occurs, and in overall lattice constant, A and B lattice constant shrinks a lot, and C lattice constant expands a little bit. And that difference, A and C, becomes order of 3%, which is a huge structure distortion. So locally, spin dimerization occurs or something like this. So here we see iridium 4 plus and iridium 4 plus, and iridium, there are six sulfur ions, so octahedral coordination, and another octahedron here, sulfur octahedron there. And these two octahedra, they share this edge. Iridium is here and iridium is there. And in paramagnetic metallic state, this distance is about 3.4 angstrom. But when this spin dimerization occurs, when these two spins form spin singlet state, there is huge lattice contraction, and this distance becomes something like 3.1 angstrom. And non-dimerized pairs, this distance is about 3.5 angstrom. And that difference is about 15%. As far as I know, in any solid, this kind of a huge local deformation, order of 15%. I think that has never been seen in any solid. There is huge structural deformation through this spin dimerization. So remember, iridium 4 plus spin 1/2, there are 5 electrons in T2G orbital. So one hole in T2G orbital. Same thing here, one hole in T2G orbital. So that hole and this hole, they couple, form spin singlet. They become very close by, about 3.1 angstrom.
You do not expect any orbital degeneracy? It's the
If
you have one hole in the
TTP,
it's three orbitals.
Three orbitals, but if they are moving around, in other words, dxy, dyz, dxz, if it's fluctuating, then it's going to be the same distance, so it's going to be more or less cubic environment. But when this thing, when this spin dimerization occurs, of course, you have to choose one direction so that it less distorts.
So you also remove a lot of the entropy at the transition there?
You remove a lot of entropy at the distance. Yes, that is correct. Yeah. That is correct. And I don't quite recall how much entropy is involved. Specific heat has been measured, but I don't recall. But we can check that later. Okay. Now, let me briefly tell you about this structural distortion at low temperature. So. The structure becomes more symmetric at low temperature, which is very unusual. Usually, low temperature structure becomes symmetric breaks, and structure becomes more distorted at low temperature. That's a typical case. But in this case, somehow tetragonal phase is low temperature, and triclinic phase is high, intermediate temperature range. And we have seen this synchrotron X-ray data like this. So at low temperature, it somehow becomes tetragonal like this. And some of this peak merges into one peak. And also, some of these super lattice peaks disappears at low temperature. But what we found is this. Actually, this disappearance is due to X-ray illumination. By shining a sample with X-ray, some of the super lattice peaks disappear with time like this. Time scale is shown here. Some of this super lattice peak intensity goes away like this. Okay. And in fact, becomes a diffusive peak. So for example, like this is the one super lattice peak. But if you go low temperature, this is a triclinic phase. You have this super lattice peak. But at low temperature, that one becomes very diffusible like this. In fact, there are two peaks. It's a dumbbell-like structure. There are two peaks centered at this position, but there are two peaks. But in this low resolution, electron diffraction pattern, it looks like a diffusive peak along this direction. That is a C direction. Okay, so super lattice peak due to this octamer formation somehow becomes very much diffusive. Basically something like that. And okay, I don't have time to go into details, but this is more or less what we think. So enhanced symmetry of every structure with cooling at low temperature is possibly due to some kind of X-ray induced disordering of translational symmetry of octamers. But somehow orientation ordering of octamers are still maintained. Okay. So it is some kind of disordering effect, but it's some specific kind. So it is a mimetic-like phase. It's induced by X-ray. So because of this translational ordering breaking, the every structure looks like a higher symmetry. But locally, in fact, it's the same with high temperature phase. Just there is disordering, additional disordering. Okay, so that is for copper iridium sulfide. And then zinc chromium oxide.
You can understand that the equilibrium structure is still triclinic, but this whatever the irradiation distorts, brings it out of equilibrium. At higher temperature, equilibrium is restored fast enough, so you don't see that. At low temperature, it stays long enough that you see this non-equilibrium structure, which looks like higher symmetry.
Well, you may say so. Yeah, so I guess the question is why it shows up at low temperature? Why this X-ray-induced transition occurs at low temperature rather than high temperature?
Right.
And it may be kind of thermal annealing effect.
It shouldn't use at high temperature
yeah.
also, and maybe it just
yeah.
recovers itself.
Yeah, maybe, maybe. Some kind of thermal annealing effect, so. Okay, so this zinc chromium oxide. Here shows the phase diagram for cadmium-doped zinc chromium oxide. As I mentioned, zinc chromium oxide, this parent compound, there is huge anti-ferromagnetic coupling. Curie-Weiss temperature is about 400 Kelvin, but long-range order temperature is about 12.5 Kelvin. So this is a pure compound. Now, cadmium, which is non-magnetic, but much larger than zinc, going into this A site, has a huge influence on magnetism. This long-range ordered transition suddenly becomes some kind of spin glass-like transition with cadmium doping, with tiny cadmium doping. And that effect is much more drastic than putting non-magnetic gallium into chromium. Chromium is 3+, spin 3.5. Gallium is also 3+. But gallium is non-magnetic. Gallium is non-magnetic. But somehow, putting this non-magnetic ion into magnetic lattice has a much slower effect than putting this non-magnetic ion to non-magnetic site, A site.
So some of this is reminiscent of what happens when you start from zinc V2O4 and you substitute lithium on the zinc site, right?
It's a little bit like that, but in that case, you also, in addition, you add carriers. Because zinc and lithium, they have a different
right.
valence state. But in this case, they have the same valence, 2+ and 2+.
So the magnetic effect seems very similar.
Right.
So one goes
in that sense, yes. The result is similar. So gallium case, this near state, just slowly going down like that. And then high enough gallium doping, this spin glass-like transition shows up like this. So this is gallium, that's for cadmium. Spin glass transition for cadmium. Okay, so here I'll discuss mainly three different regions in the phase diagram. Okay, three different regions. So I call this region A, that is below near transition temperature in pure compound. So long range ordered state I call phase A. And then phase B, or state B, is this pure compound, but above this, above 12.5 Kelvin. So this high temperature state that I call state B. And state C is cadmium dope case below this spin freezing temperature. So here, that I call state C. So I discuss those three different regions. And I'll discuss how magnetism changes, spin dynamics changes in these three different regions. Okay, first, state A. So that's pure compound at low temperature. This is the inelastic neutron scattering data. This is energy, and this is a Q. This is data on polycrystalline sample, so we do angular averaging. Okay, angular averaging, but still we have a magnitude of Q. And because of long-range order, elastic magnetic Bragg peak shows up at zero energy. This some of this yellow streak is due to those elastic magnetic Bragg peaks due to anti-ferromagnetic ordering. okay, which we will more or less ignore. But the interesting feature is this inelastic component with non-zero energy gap, about 4.5 milli electron volt energy gap. Some spin excitation shows up like this. And this position is, Q position is about 1.5 inverse angstrom. So this is an inelastic component. So inelastic component shows up in A state, a low temperature impure compound. Now, this feature becomes more or less quasi-elastic in state B. So if you go to high temperature, like this temperature, impure compound above near transition temperature, above 12.5 Kelvin, then this inelastic spin excitation becomes more or less quasi-elastic. More or less becomes quasi-elastic. What it means is this scattering intensity becomes large when energy becomes very close to zero, but when it reaches zero, this scattering intensity eventually becomes zero. Okay, so that there is no elastic component. However, if you just deviate a little bit away from zero energy, then this excitation comes in. Okay, so that's for state B. Okay, so again, this is a truly inelastic case in state A. State B case, we have a quasi-elastic. So it's almost frozen or almost moving state in these cases, in state B. And how they change as function of temperature can be shown here. It's very abrupt effect. So here, for fixed Q position, Q equals 1.5 inverse angstrom, and as function of temperature, here shows how that energy suddenly changes with this gap, about 4.5 milli electron volt gap. That inelastic component suddenly becomes quasi-elastic like here. Okay, so this is a state A and this is state B. Now, in state C, this is what happens. Here what we see is, this pure compound at low temperature. This is a low temperature. So this is a state A. So we have an elastic component plus this inelastic component in state A, that's near order the state. Now, cadmium doped case, we have a frozen spin state. Some kind of spin glass transition happens, and this is below that transition temperature. We still have this one, this inelastic one. But in addition, we have some feature here, some reddish one here, some feature here centered about 1.5 inverse angstrom. So this is a frozen state. This is a completely frozen state. This is not quasi-elastic. This is elastic component. There is elastic component in this cadmium doped case. Okay, this is state C. Okay, so we discussed three different states and also three different kinds of energy scales. This is a elastic in state C. In state B, we have a quasi-elastic, and in state A, we have a truly inelastic. Of course, this case also we do have inelastic component in state C, in addition to this elastic component.
So can you show again the quasi-elastic in state B?
Okay. So it is like this.
And that's the state between 12 Kelvin and...
So 12 Kelvin is right here, in between these two, right? So below 12 Kelvin, we have inelastic. Above 12 Kelvin, we have quasi-elastic.
And that persists?
No elastic component here, by the way.
Right. And that quasi-elastic component persists up to which temperature?
Oh, it slowly goes away. It slowly goes away. If I integrate all this energy, integrate this intensity, and we can estimate chi double prime.
Yes.
And that goes to, and then relaxation time we can estimate. And relaxation time goes to zero with decreasing zero temperature. So-called this the spin liquid picture is consistent with what happens with this quasi-elastic component. Not that component, but this quasi-elastic component, relaxation time goes to zero with decreasing temperature, linearly. Again, that is consistent with spin liquid time.
Not the relaxation time.
Yeah, relaxation rate. I'm sorry, relaxation rate. Yeah, relaxation rate goes to zero at zero temperature limit, linearly, with temperature. That data probably I don't have it here, but
can one check for omega over T scaling in that regime?
Omega and T scaling. Well, basically this this relaxation rate follows this linear temperature dependence, and that is basically consistent with if you do omega and T scaling, and it will be basically omega and T will scale.
Yeah, but since you have all the you
have
the neutron spectrum,
yeah.
When you could try to see whether the
Kaiser
refinement omega scales as a function of omega over T.
I think they do.
That's interesting.
I think they do. In other words, relaxation rate goes linear, and relaxation rate is actually from this data set. And I think they are basically the same statement, even though we didn't do that analysis.
Looks
like it's a very different temperature, but the frequency dependence looks like it's the same, like it just scales. That's why I think this data suggests. Yeah.
Sorry.
So basically, this is more and this is much less. And that goes with T. So probably they do scale.
But if you would have data between 1.7 and 15, it's the maximum is of course different. The maximum is at zero or at finite frequency. Does it shift to zero gradually?
I don't quite understand that question. But here shows what happens with temperature, right?
Okay.
Here shows what happens. Suddenly goes up.
This is
slowly going up, and suddenly becomes inelastic. Okay, so we discussed a lot about this omega dependency, right? Now, what happens with Q dependency? If you plot all these three different regions, three different states having three different dynamics, but if you plot in intensity versus Q, intensity versus Q, all of the data, sorry about this poor quality, but anyway, the bottom line is all of the data overlaps like here. It doesn't matter if it is inelastic in state A or quasi-elastic in state B or truly elastic in state C. In all cases, Q dependency is all same. Centered around 1.5 inverse angstrom, and this width is always same. The shape, the overall shape is all same. And what it means is, by the way, this is data from polycrystalline samples, not single crystals. What this means is we have some kind of spin-correlated object. Okay, spin-correlated object. And the kind of spin correlation, or let's say the shape of the spin modulation, does not change in these three different states. In addition, that's what this Q value means. In addition, this width is always same. What that means is the size of this object is always same. In this, again, different state, dynamics change drastically, but the size of this object is always same. That's what this data means, okay? So we have some fundamental this spin object, some kind of composite spin object. This object, depending on where you are in the phase space, depending on temperature or depending on chemical composition, this can be frozen, elastic, or it can be almost moving, quasi-elastic, or it can be completely moving around, inelastic, depending where you are. However, the size or the shape of this object is always the same. That's what this data means.
That looks like first order phase transition, right?
Which one?
When will this peak become suddenly quasi-elastic from inelastic?
Okay, so
you can call it all the parameters and then change.
Yes. Okay. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit more if you're interested in this. So at this temperature, suddenly it becomes like this, right? So at this temperature, in fact, there is first order structure distortion. Okay, first order structure distortion occurs here. lattice constant suddenly like this suddenly becomes like that at 12.5 Kelvin. So lattice is somehow coupled with magnetism here. And when cubic symmetry becomes tetragonal in this near order state, geometric frustration is partially broken. So some of the degeneracy is broken at this low temperature state, okay, low temperature state. And I think because the structure is involved, that the transition becomes first order. So that this one also suddenly changes. It is first order transition. So in some sense, this is some kind of a three-dimensional version of a spin pirate transition. There is a huge spin degeneracy in this problem, in this system. And suddenly, by having structure distortion, some of the degeneracy is lifted. Okay, and then this is what happens: near state plus this inelastic component.
There's no
comes
frustration
in.
Past transition, so this is everything is here.
So a kind of frustration version of spin pirates, or Jan Taylor in some sense.
Have you done specific heat?
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
Yeah. Yes. Thanks. Yes. That, let me come back later because that's. Related with kind of the second.
Well, we would like to know.
No, actually.
I think there's a lot of entropy.
No, actually, not much. Lattice, okay, even though there is a clear lattice distortion, let's see if we can see numbers. The structure deformation is clearly there, but it's very, very small. Okay, we can barely measure. This is synchrotron X-ray data. So well, it seems like there is decent distortion, but distortion is in fact small. I think this is 10 to the minus 3. So if this is the order of 0.1%. It is order of 0.1% compared with the copper iridium sulfide where we say 3%. This is very small. But anyway, the entropy up to this temperature corresponds to about 1/6 of R log. 3/2 and then to 4, R log 4. So spin 3/2, right? So R log 4 is what you expect from the spin part. But what we see here is only 1/6 shows up to about here, okay?
Yeah,
about 1/6. Just above this temperature here, if we integrate up to this temperature, we get about 1/6, okay? So basically, what it means is this spin freezing was in a near transition. I think the contribution from structure is very small somehow, even the structure does deform. And spin entropy disappearance is only like 1/6. And 5/6 majority spin slowly goes away from very high temperature when you approach here. How is the main subject of this discussion, right? So I hope I convinced you. We have some very interesting spin object, and the size and then the shape and it's all well defined. But this can move around, or elastic or quasi elastic. I hope I convinced that part so far. Now, and finally we got some single crystal of pure compound, not the doped one, pure compound. And single crystal, and then we reserved all this H and K, and this object in HK plane look like this. This is experimental data. Okay, this is experimental data, and this is our calculation based on this kind of object. So we assumed first 6 spins on a hexagon. We assumed and completely anti-ferromagnetic arrangement of spins, collinear anti-ferromagnetic arrangement of 6 spins on one hexagon. That's what we assumed. And then we assumed that there's 4 different orientation. And then if you compute form factor for this object, Okay, not local atomic object, but this rather big object. Form factor goes something like this. And the scattering intensity should be square of this times square of individual chromium 3 plus ion form factor. So that's what is supposedly. If we assume, so again, we start from this object. We call this a hexamer. So six spins, completely antiferromagnetic, collinear spin arrangement. And this scattering intensity with hexamer spins, scattering intensity is supposedly like this. They are very, very similar with experimental result. Okay. Experimental result. So basically what this means is this spin object, spin cluster object I was talking about is in fact more or less this. It's six spins, antiferromagnetically coupled. But the overall direction of this spin, what you may call this spin director, is still arbitrary. It can be anywhere in the 3D, three dimension. Okay? That direction can be anywhere in the three dimension. That's the spin object we are talking about. Okay? That spin object, it can be moved, again, depending on where you are in the phase space, this object can be dynamic or quasi-elastic or elastic. One second. Now, so remember, this is the system having huge antiferromagnetic coupling. Piriwise temperature is order of 400 Kelvin. There is a huge magnetic coupling. Huge magnetic coupling. So that the system wants to order. When you cool down from, let's say, from 400 Kelvin, 400 Kelvin is more or less Curie-Weiss temperature. If you cool down, keep cool down, and then if you come, you know, order of 10 Kelvin temperature range, the system wants to order, but they simply cannot order because of geometric frustration, unless symmetry is broken through structural deformation. So if there is no deformation, if the symmetry is still cubic, then you still have this all this degeneracy, then the system cannot order. But what it can do is it can order locally. Within hexagon, spins can completely order with a collinear antiferromagnetic spin arrangement. But overall spin orientation of those six spins, they can be still random. So this picture is consistent with this 1/6 entropy, 1/6 of R log 4 entropy. So 5/6 entropy is gone when you cool down from 400 Kelvin down to, let's say, 13 Kelvin, just above the transition temperature. And then what happens, the transition is that the last 1/6 R log 4, that entropy disappears. Okay, so that picture is very consistent. Okay, yes?
So do I understand you right that this spin object has a director but not a vector? Like
more or less, more or less. More or less.
So then it's probably, if you try to apply mechanical like pneumatic liquid crystal theory to that, you would get a first order transition like this, so pet transition or whatever it's called.
Okay, okay, maybe.
And that's very well worked out. Did you try to compare that?
That's more or less the idea, but
entropy and everything.
Yeah, at least entropy more or less works. Entropy more or less works. Okay. Okay. But okay. So far that was a more or less picture, but it doesn't tell us how come that is possible. In other words, these six spins antiferromagnetic, and then next, let's say hexagon and six spins. You know how they can be completely decoupled? It's not obvious. Right, it's not obvious.
Yeah,
let me give you some argument.
Right, if they order eventually, then there is some interaction between them.
Well, so okay. So let's see how my argument goes for that part. Okay, so now let's think about. Okay, so let's. Okay, well, before I go into that one, maybe I mention this. So this is some kind of a composite degrees of freedom. Okay, composite degrees of freedom. If you go order of 10 Kelvin temperature range or very low energy scale, then we have only this object, this spin object, this spin coupled object, cluster, hexagon cluster or hexamers. We don't have to worry about individual spins. Okay. Okay, so this problem is very much like, let's say, you know, say, low energy, you worry about proton and neutron. You don't have to worry about all these gluons and quarks and stuff like that, right? Low energy, you worry about only proton and neutron. So there is a, this is a, some kind of composite degrees of freedom, but for low temperature or low energy scale, that's the only thing you have to worry about. But anyway, this kind of coupling or decoupling of this spin hexamers, how they can come about, that's what I'm going to discuss. I don't have time, I guess.
No, that's all right.
Okay. Well, maybe, let's see how it goes. Maybe about a couple more minutes. We start 5 minutes late anyway. Okay. Santa Barbara.
The tradition here is that people sit as long as it's interesting.
Okay. Okay. So now let's think about one. Okay, now let's think about just one isolated tetrahedron, okay? One isolated tetrahedron. And we have four spins, like this, four spins here. And we have, let's say, we assume anti-ferromagnetic coupling along these edges. Then as long as the net moment is zero, then that's ground state. And there are many ways we can arrange these spins so that net moment can be zero. Here shows one example. Let's say if you split these four spins into two like this and two like that, then we can see here the net spin is zero, right? These two produce net spin that, those two produce net spin opposite, so that net spin becomes zero. So
now we are back to tetrahedron,
right? One isolated tetrahedron, not connected. Okay, one isolated tetrahedron with four spins.
You push the picture with this.
No. Okay. So we again we consider only one tetrahedron.
Yeah.
They are not coupled. Okay. So in this case, for the ground state, we have tons of degeneracy. That degeneracy is something to do with changing this angle theta and also changing this angle phi. Okay. So we have that much freedom. Even if we change theta and also we phi, still net moment is zero, so that it's still ground state. Okay, so that's for one isolated tetrahedron.
You're talking about classical spins.
No? Classical spin, yeah. It's all classical spin, yeah. Classical spin, and at the end, you know, what real quantum spin will do will be really interesting. But don't forget this spin 3/2, so that. Classical spin might be enough. Okay.
You have a gap to spin excitation. Whatever you do, you will have a large gap to make a magnetic state out of.
Okay. So let's see how this argument goes. Okay. So let's think about, for the sake of simplicity, let's think about just the collinear case. In other words, when this theta is zero. Okay. When this theta is zero, we have a spin going up and down, red spin. And then blue spin going up and down, okay? So when theta is zero, in other words, collinear spin case, excuse me, we can still change this angle phi, okay? So we can still, so two spins is like one director, spin director, another spin like a spin director. We can still change this angle like this. This phi we can change. We still have ground state. We have still that much freedom. Now, this kind of freedom, basically, in general, this kind of freedom disappears when you put this tetrahedron in a lattice. In other words, if you connect many tetrahedra, corner sharing or whatever, this kind of freedom, in general, it disappears. But one can think about a very special case. Okay, one can think about a very special case. That's a spinner, basically. So let's see, if we connect the six tetrahedra like this, so we connect the six tetrahedra and form this hexagon like that, okay? Now form that hexagon like that. And if we move these red spins at the same time, so this is a very special kind of special arrangement of tetrahedral network. In fact, this is what happens in in spinel case, and we learned this kind of hexagonal decomposition is all possible in spinel case. Now, if you move these red spins a little bit like that, if we move spin a little bit like this, but we move these spins, these two spins, but we move, if we move all these six spins all together at the same time, that is like moving this spin director from here to there. Then this one does not cost any energy. I hope that's clear. So this hexagon spin director, even if we move, that does not cost any energy. It can move around without disturbing any other neighboring spins. So in this way, hexamers, one hexamers and the next hexamers, they can be completely decoupled. So if you arrange these spin directors in three-dimensional way, then it looks like some complicated shape like this. I hope it's clear for you. So more or less, this is a conclusion. So we learned about this tiling issue and this hexamers. For low energy spin excitation, this becomes very important. And octamers, we also learned. And through charge ordering, this octamers do form in this leading spinners. Okay, all right, let me stop here. Okay.
The last picture is shown.
Okay.
You assume that the coupling constant, not this one, the one that you conclude.
This one?
Yes, this
okay,
one.
Yes.
You first compose a composite beam at the center of the red one, right? Then
yes.
You argue that it doesn't matter what direction you point to. But in this process, you already assume that, for example, if I'm looking at the yellow, the coupling between the yellow one and the red one.
Yes.
You can see that, for example, the yellow one only points are very close to the original there are six red ones, but only part of them are close to the yellow one, right?
Yeah, right. So these two belongs to next yellow hexagon like here.
Yes.
Okay.
There are only two.
And this hexagon, this hexagon and that hexagon, they're coupled through these four spins.
Yes.
That's basically what you're saying.
Yes,
that is true.
That's precisely the issue.
Yeah.
If you first compose the composite spin using all the red one, then you try to see whether that matter to the neighboring side. Of course.
Right.
Your conclusion is no, right? But the fact that you have composed this composite spin, you already made assumption that coupling between the yellow one, the red one and the yellow ones are the same for all the red one and all the yellow one.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that if
you're
taking into account the fact that the distance between the yellow one and all the red ones are not the same.
You mean this and that? Is that what you mean?
The one at the left one, the far away, yeah.
Let's say this one. And this
the
one.
Yellow one, yeah.
This
the
yellow
distance
one.
Is different.
Oh, we consider only nearest neighbor coupling in this argument and also classical spins, but nearest neighbor coupling like here,
yeah.
That's the argument we are using.
Words, you don't have allowed any interaction between the yellow one and the
that is correct.
Red.
That is correct. Yes. So the nearest neighbor coupling through this tetrahedron, yes.
Which means that you cannot sum all the red ones first, right? Because the coupling constant is not the same for all the red ones.
Pretty much same. Pretty much, unless you consider this lattice distortion, all this coupling is the same.
But not the red, not the red one at far end, right?
Red.
I'm considering the yellow one.
This one.
Yes.
Versus that one, you mean?
Yes. Yes. So that's not the same interaction.
There is no, this is far away.
Yeah, precisely. So you cannot sum all the red ones together first, right?
Why not?
I don't, you're asking why this decomposition occurs first. I think that's what you're asking.
That's again like a spontaneous
symmetry breaking time.
The interaction between the yellow hexagon and the red one, I cannot sum them together first and then say they don't interact.
Okay, maybe you should show here.
So first, if I sum them together and sum this together, then say that's considered entire interaction, and the direction doesn't matter. Right?
Okay, right.
Because no matter how you plotted it, eventually you'll cancel out with all these six of them.
Okay.
Right, that's the cancellation.
Right.
Now, if I want to say, I want to consider the interaction between the yellow one and the red one and the yellow one, and if I don't do the sum to get this vector in the first place,
okay,
that's just consider them
individual. Yeah.
It turns out that this interaction and this interaction have very different magnitude, right? In your case, if this is non-zero, this is zero.
No, no, interaction is all the same.
No,
interaction and scale is the same.
Between these two and these two.
Oh, they are different, right?
So
yeah.
This is non-zero and this is zero. Right?
That is correct. Yeah, that is correct.
Yeah, so individually, this one is down zero, this is zero.
So in other words, nearest neighbor coupling, that's the only one we consider here. Okay.
And now, if I want to consider all the effect of all the red spin to this yellow one,
okay,
I cannot just sum them together, can I? I can't, right? Because some of them are non zero, some of them are zero.
Wait a minute. So for this one, the only one you have to consider these two, because we assume nearest neighbor coupling. Right.
Yeah,
so you consider, but there is a triangle here, so it's frustrated. That's the beauty here.
Yes, yes, and
it's
so
frustrated here.
The argument
here
is that these two is enough to make this one feel nothing.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's the point. That's the whole point. Yes.
The touchy point is that he did the separation in the first place, and
you are absolutely right.
So but after you done that, then
the rest follows. Yeah, you are right. So in other words, I have to somehow break symmetry in order to form this this hexagon force. In other words, I can form that hexagon too.
Yeah.
It's all same probability. But once I form this, then decoupling naturally occurs. That's the point, right? That's the point. So, I mean, you can argue why that happens. That, in some sense, I mean, why spontaneous symmetry breaking occurs, right? I mean, that is, I don't know, but experimentally we see this object. We see this object, so, right? But once we do that, then the decoupling through the, because of, that's simply because of this tetrahedral geometric frustration. That's the beauty, right? This connection between these two objects is done through this tetrahedron, but tetrahedron itself has this beautiful this frustration. We can change this angle phi, right? That freedom allows us decoupling.
Why does he want to make these hexagons in first place?
So what do you mean?
What does he want to make these complex objects?
Why they want to?
What's the driving force for?
You know, the thing is, they have this huge magnetic coupling energy scale, like 400 Kelvin. Now we are talking about 10 Kelvin, right? So there's a huge magnetic energy scale that they want to order, the system want to order. But frustration somehow prevents this. So the way they become, the system becomes happy is forming this object. Locally, kind of a symmetry breaking.
Yeah, I can imagine there could be many other ways to do about the same.
Well, I hope you can find some other object. I don't see any yet. Well, it can be octomer, for example. It can be octomer, still we can do the same game. So then you can ask, why not octomer? Nature somehow chose the simpler one, hexagon rather than octomers.
So
where
we
leave
this?
Okay, well, then what do we do about this other subject?
Okay, so.
It's all up to you.
Maybe you should just know what would be the possible topic for this informal discussion.
I think manganese, right? I mean,
manganese,
can you say again what is the other thing you would like to
okay,
do?
So I could find
No,
it's the very first the transparency was there. Okay, so again, this composite degrees of freedom, right? It's a similar kind of a composite degrees of freedom occurs in manganite.
I would suggest we really make it an informal discussion with people interested. So Igor, obviously
I'm
you
interested,
are interested.
I'll be also interested.
You're also interested? You're also? Okay, great.
Okay.
So maybe we can schedule that, let's see.
Maybe later today after town stop or tomorrow.
Today?
Later today is possible. You know, we can keep it. The schedule this week is terribly packed. There are all sorts of talks.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I see.
I mean, not only from the workshop, but
I mean,
ITP talks, colloquia, blah, 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 blah.
But can you,
so,
I mean, I'm going to be here, you know, for the rest of this week. I don't have any other plans, or at least I don't have something for the rest of this week.
I have a problem because I'm leaving later today, tomorrow, I'm going for the rest of the week to Stanford.
Oh, I see.
So I will be here
tomorrow,
today, and maybe tomorrow till probably 4.
Do
maybe
we have anything tomorrow morning?
That's what I wonder.
Okay.
I don't remember.
What's on the schedule tomorrow morning?
I don't remember meeting. There is a talk tomorrow afternoon.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, right. So Igor, why don't you...
10 o'clock, same?
Right, I suggest the interested people meet with Sangwu tomorrow, say 10.
Yeah, okay.
I may or may not come depending on the, how things go. But let's see where we can do it.
You can send this
yes, I send an email. Yes, I send an email. And probably we can do that here because we usually have the room.
Okay. Okay, very good.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
I'd like to talk to you more about this quasi-elastic regime above
the transition.
Above
okay.
Transition.
Okay.
Because
okay.
We have some theories of the spin liquid regime in isolated systems
okay.
that could be directly relevant.
Okay.
So
okay.
That
let me collect some papers. Maybe that's
the width of your peak was not really changing very much in temperature, right?
It's the same.
It's
basically the PCP. Yeah, Q equals 1.5 inverse angstrom. I mean, that one is always the same. Doesn't matter.
It's position, yeah.
Q position is basically
position.
The same. Yeah,
but
yeah.
Also the width of the.
It's always same.
Because it's also
always same.
Very
yeah.
little changing
yeah.
at all.
So that tells us it's a.
This correlation length is not very.
Or I would say there's a cluster size.
Hmm?
I would say that the cluster size is the same,
cluster size,
or correlation length, or cluster size.
Yeah.
So you know
yeah.
that is a more or less actually this hexagon.
All right. And then the question is why is an entropy change as you say occurs gradually after transition?
Oh, because you know this the is it, wait a minute gradually that's you know, high temperature. Yeah. Okay. That's because
yeah.
that's because you know it's simple this antiferromagnetic collinear spin arrangement does not happen you know instantaneously. Slowly builds up. High temperature is fluctuating a little bit more. When you approach from 400 Kelvin, you go down to let's say 13 Kelvin. High temperature is almost paramagnetic, right? And slowly freezes into these hexamers. That freezing slowly occurs from 400 Kelvin to 13 Kelvin. And then what happens at 12.5 Kelvin is you know the even the hexagon this two object
then
basically freezes.
Your inelastic peak would change its width.
No. Once this is the if this freezing occurs within hexamer, the size will be the Q width will be same. Because that's correlation length. The correlation length is more the size of this hexamer. Hexagon, which is you know pretty much something like 6 or 7 angstrom, that does not change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What if you enable the say the interaction, not just the nearest neighbor interaction, but only the say
what?
The next neighbor?
Oh,
does that still have the same thing?
What am I supposed to do with this?
That will turn it off.
At least I should turn off something.
That's fine. Just leave
it here.
Yeah,
okay. That's a good question. And also,
here I don't
want to see.
Do you still have the transparency?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not clear to me whether you can still have this nice.
Maybe this one.
Yeah. So. Let's see. Maybe this one. Yeah. So, I finally get to the point. So these two are opposite in direction.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
why
collinear.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that's why you claim that it doesn't matter because each one
correct.
Of them see
that
both of them.
That is correct.
And but you do agree that if I see this red and green one,
yeah.